Okay, what if we forget what Jay Powell is thinking and instead worry about why he is thinking it? How about that, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 18th of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I will give you three guesses who we start with on this Friday, and the first two don't count. Here's a hint, if you somehow need it. His initials are Jay Powell. Gina Smilex at the New York Times, Sudeep Reddy's at Politico. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Gina, let me ask you this, first of all, about Mr. Powell, the Federal Reserve, of course, raising interest rates for the first time in three-ish years, a quarter of a percentage point. Here's my question. He made a very strong case that the economy is very strong, as it is, right? Labor market's good. Consumers are spending money. There is some growth. Why only a quarter of a percentage point? Because honestly, that's not that much.
Right. So I think that the idea here, based on everything he's been saying publicly and his colleagues have been saying publicly, is that you go ahead and get going at sort of this moderate, regular pace. You just go quarter point after quarter point after quarter point, and that's a pretty good way to steadily remove accommodation. And you save those 50-point sort of, you know, the jumbo-sized interest rate increases in your back pocket in case you need to communicate to markets that you have suddenly gotten very worried and that you are getting serious now. And so I think it's more about stocking up the ammunition and less about, you know, an assessment that the labor market isn't strong or that the economy isn't ready for it.
Sudeep, about the what is not what is Jay Powell thinking, but why he's thinking it. Do you suppose he, well, this is a ridiculous question, but I'll ask it and then you can answer it. Do you suppose he's not worried about 8% inflation? That can't be the case, right?
He is worried about 8% inflation, obviously, but he's also worried about breaking the labor market at the same time. And he's trying to do what really every central banker has tried to do, which is to have such perfect policy that nothing goes wrong. Along the way, and of course, it never works that way. Something's going to go wrong when you do this, and inflation is already at 8%. We'll see whether we get 9 or 10% in the coming months. That's not, you don't want that on your record. He's been in charge for 4 years. It's on it's his to deal with. But you also, like, are you allowed to raise interest rates by 50 basis points when you're facing a potential world war? Like, is that what it says in the central banker's handbook? So he's looking at all this and thinking, okay, well, there are all these headwinds. What do I do right now? You just go slow, be careful with it, and don't break anything yourself if something else might break on its own.
All right, we'll get back to the war in a minute. Gina, I want to go to you for a historical perspective here, and we will point out, number one, that you're writing a book on the Fed, and number two, there's a much longer version of the question I'm about to ask you on the Daily from the New York Times from about like 3 days ago. But here's the question. Much has been made of this moment as Jay Powell's Paul Volcker moment, right? Volcker in the late 70s, early 80s, breaking the back of inflation. Why is this not the 1970s?
I think this isn't the 1970s, basically because we've had the 1970s. So, you know, Jay Powell is looking at Paul Volcker as a real sort of inspiration, as somebody who did the right thing and got this under control. And what we had before the 70s was basically 15 years when people did not move aggressively enough. Central bankers did not move fast enough to get inflation under control. We had a long period where inflation just became sort of part of the ethos of everyday life. And what we haven't had this time is that sort of long period of out of control inflation. It's only been a year. So I think that's the big difference.
All right. Okay. Sudeep, last question on the Fed and then actually two more. But the one that I'm going to throw to you is this. There is still a $9 trillion balance sheet sitting on Jay Powell's desk at the Federal Reserve. They're not going to start running that off. That is to say, making it smaller. Until like May at the earliest. I think Powell said, you know, some future meeting. Why wait?
This is really the question. And actually, we had several Fed officials coming out today and kind of airing their grievances in public that maybe they do need to actually go sooner. Maybe they need to go sooner on the size of the rate increases. Maybe they need to go sooner on the on all of this, on cutting the balance sheet, on tightening policy. And that's going to be really the pressure point in the coming months. How do you deal with inflation that the Fed is not really equipped to deal with that well? And your one blunt tool or in this case, two. Jay Powell loves to talk about tools. He's got these tools to deal with this, and they're going to have to fight over how much do they want to hurt the labor market and hurt other issues to deal with something that is obviously painful right now in inflation, and that is the balancing act that they're going to go through.
Yeah, we're going to do a thing on tools actually in the next like week or so, because it's really interesting, right? Everybody thinks the Fed has all these things, but maybe they kind of don't. Anyway, Gina, last question on the Fed. It was interesting to me that Chair Powell, in response to, I think it was a question from Neil Irwin, now of Axios, formerly of The Times, Neil basically said, "What do you think?" As in, you know, we get all these anonymous dot plot projections on the summary of economic projections. We can't tell which one's yours. Which do you... what do you actually think is going to happen, Jay Powell? And he basically said, it's not my job. My job is to represent the committee, which to me was really interesting.
Yeah, I think that's very much the view Fed chairs tend to take about those press conferences. It's really not their, you know, their position to go out there and hammer home whatever they think is the case. They're supposed to be representing some sort of consensus view. Now, I will say it is sometimes the case that the consensus view is very much dragged forward by the chair, as we all know. And so I think, you know, those things can both be true. They coexist.
Yeah. All right. Sudeep, I want to get back to your thing about war uncertainty in the Federal Reserve, but the larger economy. And as President Biden said when he first started talking about sanctions, this is going to cut both ways. What is left, do you suppose, other than completely globally shutting down the Russian energy sector? What's left for the West to do? You got 30 seconds.
That is really the big thing. This is the energy is how Vladimir Putin gets his money. This is what the last bit of lifeblood is. The blood that's going through the system is from energy. Everything we're seeing now. Ending permanent normal trade relations, all the things, these are all just symbolic measures. They're all signals to say that Russia, you're done. You're not coming back while Putin's in charge. And so there isn't a whole lot more other than essentially the final button. Like, are you really going to cut them off? And they might decide you might cut off the central bank and do other things that even more forcefully, but it's all going to come down to the energy question. How much pain is Europe and Germany in particular willing to sustain in cutting off Russian energy imports into their countries? And that is the kind of the murder-suicide question as well there, because it's going to blow right back on them when they do it.
Sudeep Reddy at Politico, Gina Smilek at The New York Times. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks,
Kai. Weekend. On Wall Street today, what? Me worry? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The running time for the video conference that President Biden and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping had today was just shy of 2 hours. You're allowed time for translation, maybe a Zoom glitch or two, figure 45 minutes, maybe an hour of actual content, the gist of which was Biden saying there would be consequences, and that's the word the White House gave reporters, if China continues its partnership with Moscow, and Xi calling the West sanctions indiscriminate. A month into this war, almost, the White House has spent a lot of time warning China not to backfill what the West sanctions are taking away from Russia, but let's say Beijing just wanted to do that anyway. Marketplace's Lily Jamali explains how.
One way China could help Russia cushion the blow from Western sanctions is to keep trading normally with it to the extent that it can. And Xiang Jinwei, an expert on the Chinese economy at Columbia, says China has ways to do that.
They don't have to use dollar for trade. They don't have to use SWIFT system to do the financial transactions.
SWIFT being the financial messaging system that Russia was kicked out of when it faced sanctions for invading Ukraine. Turns out China and Russia have their own versions of SWIFT, Wei says. Dartmouth professor Pamela Crossley says China has been waiting for a moment like this.
It's been a longstanding ambition of Xi Jinping to develop all kinds of alternative structures relating to international finance and trade.
But change isn't easy. Take energy. Russia could reorient its exports from west to east, says Mary Lovely, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
The Russians could send more gas to China. I'm sure China would negotiate a very good price on that.
Russia's problems aren't limited to its exports. It also needs to import a lot of stuff, like semiconductor chips. Obviously, China can't make everything itself, but it has experience serving as a sort of middleman for sanctioned nations like North Korea and Iran that can't buy and sell goods directly, says Victor Shi of UC San Diego.
China has developed a tactic whereby they set up or use a small financial institution or firm to conduct these activities that are in violation of sanctions.
If those small firms get caught and hit with U.S. sanctions, she says that wouldn't affect the rest of China's economy much. And with hundreds of billions of dollars in trade between the U.S. and China each year, both nations are likely to tread carefully. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
There's vaccine news of note this week. Both Moderna and Pfizer say they are going to ask the FDA to authorize a fourth COVID shot. Moderna for people 18 and older, Pfizer 65 and up. Those vaccines in this country are free for everybody. But federal pandemic healthcare funding is about to run out, and Congress is, of course, still arguing about what to do, which means, among other things, that vaccines aren't going to be free anymore for people without insurance. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has been covering vaccines for us.
If all this federal funding goes away, people without insurance will have to pay out of pocket for a COVID booster. Sarah Priestley, owner of Heart Pharmacy in Cincinnati, says the price will depend on two things: the cost of the actual vaccine, which right now the federal government buys and provides for free.
What Pfizer and Moderna and Johnson decide to charge us.
She says that could be $10 or it could be $100. Plus, the pharmacy's administrative fee, the cost of paperwork and staffing. If you're uninsured, the federal government currently covers that, too. It's around $40 a shot. Ambar Kaluskar at Rossi Pharmacy in Brooklyn says pharmacies can't waive those fees for just the uninsured. Under their contracts with insurance companies and Medicare,
when you charge someone $0, you're actually required to charge everyone $0.
In other words, the pharmacy has to charge a fee for all patients or none of them. And if it's none of them, a lot of pharmacies can't afford to do these vaccinations at all. So if you're uninsured, a little back of the envelope math here, a COVID booster would probably cost between $50 and $150. Susan Bellantonio is 63 and lives in Washington State. She's uninsured, on Social Security and delivering for DoorDash. She'd like to get a booster when it's time, but she can't afford the high end of that range.
Being on the extremely limited fixed income that I have and the fact that DoorDash is, it's almost a wash right now, I would have to go with the lower end, if at all.
When we talked, she was at McDonald's picking up a DoorDash order. Sometimes, like yesterday, she makes as little as $20 a day. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Coming up,
they said that they were going to bring a whole bunch of jobs.
And we're waiting. All right, first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, here you go on a Friday. Dow Industrial's up 274, 0.8%, 34,754. The NASDAQ lifted 279 points, 2%, 13,893. The S&P 500 up 51, 1.2%, 44.63. For the week, the Dow found 5.5%. The NASDAQ added 8.2%. The S&P 500 up 6.2%. Sad happy music indeed. Pfizer up 0.5% today. Moderna up 6.3%. Finland now has a 5-year streak of being the happiest country in the world. So finds the World Happiness Report. Looks at 146 countries and their GDP, their social infrastructure, the contentedness of the population. Data collected by Gallup. This year, Denmark is number 2, followed by Iceland. I'm going to hang out here, give it a beat or two, and let you guess where the United States comes in. 16. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. You know, groups and organizations and companies, big and small, are trying to figure out their relationship with Russia. Manufacturers, financials, consumer goods, and the arts as well. The soprano Anna Netrebko withdrew from upcoming performances with the Metropolitan Opera in New York the other day after she refused to distance herself from her past support of Vladimir Putin. A Russian donor has stepped down from the board of trustees at the Guggenheim Museum. So Marketplace's Kristen Schwab on the arts economy and the war now.
Nonprofits sometimes turn a blind eye to donors' backgrounds. If you don't ask questions, you don't have to deal with the answers. Patricia Illingworth researches philanthropy and ethics at Northeastern University.
The default position is the donation is good, the donor is good. And so what you don't get is much vetting at all.
But the conversation around vetting donors has been changing because of Jeffrey Epstein, the Sackler family, and now because of Russia. Because Illingworth says it's unethical for an arts organization to take tainted money, and doing so helps launder the donor's image or even justify their bad behavior.
Like if you've been on a diet, a rigorous diet, and, you know, then you all of a sudden, you know, eat a pint of chocolate ice cream, right? You sort of balance out your good with the bad.
Arts organizations also have to figure out how to handle Russian artists, who really have nothing to do with the war. Hemina Varela directs the arts management program at American University. She says for decades, featuring Russian guest artists was a point of pride for ballet and opera companies in the U.S.
If an artist came from a country where repression, human rights abuses were common, the artist was separate from that, and the artists were welcomed.
Now institutions are grappling with whether they should cut ties with people who won't denounce the war and Putin. Thing is, very few artists are likely to do that. Art in Russia is heavily funded by the government, which means Putin is behind performers' paychecks. So going to jail isn't the only risk artists face if they denounce him.
It's social isolation. It's not being able to perform. It has enormous consequences.
A ballerina with the Bolshoi Ballet recently spoke out against the war, and Dutch National Ballet quickly hired her. But only the most prominent artists can do that. Amy Fullman, a cultural relations and policy consultant, says cutting ties with Russian artists isn't about punishing individuals. It's about damaging Russia's soft power and cutting off its access to the outside world.
They're going to feel that. Any closing door is going to have an effect.
Especially in a country where excellence in arts and sports is a great source of pride. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
We've been talking cryptocurrency the past couple of Fridays, cryptocurrency mining specifically, the energy-intensive but potentially quite lucrative computing process of creating and basically doing all the accounting for the various cryptocurrencies that are out there. Up until last summer, China was the place to be if you were a crypto miner, in part because of relatively cheap hydropower. And then the government changed its mind about crypto, cracked down on it, and a whole lot of mining companies packed up and started looking for where they could get cheap electricity. Kazakhstan, for some, Iran, for others, Texas, too. And the Chinese weren't the only ones to set up shop in the Lone Star State. Quite a few American crypto miners went there for the same reason, relatively cheap electricity. Marketplace's Andy Euler has that story now from a Texas town that's kind of betting the farm on crypto mining.
If there's one thing that's dictated the development of Rockdale, Texas over the years, it's energy. Heath Davidson's family is living proof. His dad went to high school here.
Once he graduated, I think he graduated in 76, he graduated, and right that summer he went directly to the coal mine.
The giant lignite mine just north of town. He started out operating a bulldozer.
Worked his way up, and he eventually was operating the drag line, and then he ended up becoming a supervisor out there, and he worked his way up to superintendent.
So it's not surprising that after Heath Davidson came back home with a degree from Texas A&M, he went to work at the Sandow power plant in town, where the coal that his dad mined generated electricity.
I was working on turbine generator, working on, you know, the scrubber and things like that. My uncle, who is my dad's brother, was actually our control room operator.
But 5 years later, in 2018, the owners of the power plant shut it down as the Obama administration was cracking down on plants that burned dirty lignite. That eliminated almost 500 jobs, including Heath Davidson's. It was yet another blow to the economy of a town that had suffered quite a few of them. But then it seemed like a lifeline was coming to town. A Chinese Bitcoin mining company saw the potential of cheap energy in Rockdale, thanks to the state's deregulated energy market. It was setting up shop near the shuttered power plant.
They said that they were going to bring a whole bunch of jobs, and I actually interviewed with them and went through an interview process with them, and then they just weren't hiring.
Rockdale, Texas was getting its first taste of just how volatile cryptocurrencies can be. The price of Bitcoin tanked, and the Chinese company scaled back its plans. Wired magazine got wind and called Rockdale the hard luck Texas town that bet on Bitcoin and lost. An article that caught the eye of a Bitcoin entrepreneur in New Orleans.
I read it as opportunity. I was like, hey, if there's power, there's opportunity.
Chad Harris is CEO of Windstone US, which is now part of publicly traded Riot Blockchain. He started digging around for more information about Rockdale and says he remembers getting a text message with a picture of, you guessed it, the Sandow power plant, where Heath Davidson used to work.
So I'm like, I literally see it, and I think of the rainbow, Lucky Charms, right? And it's like, holy cow, we have found it.
Now, it wasn't that Harris wanted to reopen the power plant, but he saw that it was still alongside massive electrical infrastructure, transmission lines, switching stations, and transformers. It was the perfect place for another new crypto mining plant, one that he says will ultimately eat up some 750 megawatts of power, enough electricity for more than a third of a million homes. All of that infrastructure had been built to serve what was once the largest aluminum smelting plant in the country. John King worked at the Alcoa plant before he became mayor of Rockdale.
They came in probably in 51, built power plants to supplement what was necessary to do the smelting. They had three 95 megawatt power plants out there.
And ultimately added two more, including the Sandow plant where Heath Davidson used to work. And they were all there because of that 100 million tons of lignite coal just north of town, where Heath Davidson's dad started working after high school. Rockdale's population had doubled. The Saturday Evening Post called it the town where it rains money. But in 2008, Alcoa said it was shutting the smelter down and those jobs were gone. Jim Gibson, executive director of the Rockdale Municipal Development District, says he doesn't expect it to rain money in Rockdale anytime soon, but he hopes crypto coming to town will help fill some gaps.
What I heard was that there were 5,000 some odd people that were employed at Alcoa and the two power plants. And between the crypto companies and other industrial developments, we should get that back.
That's a tall order, but in addition to the Windstone U.S. mine, the Chinese firm that gave the town false hope a few years ago is back. And Rockdale's Mayor John King says the town gets two or three inquiries a week from crypto companies. Heath Davidson's already benefiting from the new mining neighbors. A couple of years ago, he was at a restaurant in town that his friend owns, watching the World Series, when he met one of the guys setting up the Windstone U.S. mine in Rockdale.
He said, hey, all I could tell you is, you know, put your application in and come hit the ground running. And so I started out in inventory. Then I proceeded to go to miner installation team. Then I became an assistant supervisor. And then I ended up becoming a manager. And now I'm a director of operations. So
his dad rose through the ranks in the coal mine. Now Heath Davidson's done the same thing at the Bitcoin mine. In Rockdale, Texas, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
We're going to wrap up our crypto mining series next week. Another Andy Euler piece, how oil and gas are jumping in here too. This final note on the way out today, an update on that $117 million Russian bond payment we've talked about a couple of times this week, in the context, I think, of would Moscow default or wouldn't it? Spoiler alert, they didn't. Remember, these are U.S. dollar-denominated bonds, so payment was due in dollars. It has been made. Moscow sent the money to J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan sent it to Citigroup. Citigroup paid out the bondholders. But if you are wondering, as was I, wait. What about all those sanctions? Haven't Russian banks been frozen out, shut out of SWIFT and all of that? Well, it seems the Treasury Department's all right with Russia making bond payments, at least through May, anyway. All right, we're gone, but here is your moment of economic context. It has been a while since we've updated this one, I think. From the folks down at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach, the latest container ship traffic jam count. Any guesses? And yes, I know we're starting with a quiz today and ending with a quiz, but anyway. So I'll give you a hint. The record was 109 back in January. Where do you think we are? 48 as of yesterday. Up for the week, it should be said, but going the right way, I think. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will see you on Monday, all right? This is APM.